This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A major Iraqi group regularly accused of targeting American facilities calls the recent rocket attack on the U.S. embassy in Baghdad a false flag strike and a plot by Washington. Several European nations began their coronavirus vaccination programs amid lockdowns and concerns about the spread of a new variant of the virus. The UK's fishing industry chief criticized the post-Brexit deal and says the government went back on the promise to regain full control over fishing lines. Good to have you with us. Starting with some news from Iraq, the paramilitary group Kataib Hezbollah is saying the recent attack on the U.S. embassy in Baghdad was a false flag strike and a plot hatched by rulers in Washington. In an interview with Al Jazeera, the group's spokesman, Mohammed Mohi, says it's only American officials who benefit from an attack on their own embassy. He noted that the White House intends to ratchet up the pressure on Iraqi resistance groups, especially those preparing to mark the anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iranian General Soleimani and Iraqi commander al-Muhandis. He said that resistance groups abide by the truce that they had declared, and if they are supposed to end it, they will announce it publicly. Washington regularly accuses Kataib Hezbollah of targeting American facilities on Iraqi soil. Resistance delegates from Syria, Palestine, and Iraq have come together in the Syrian capital to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Iranian General Soleimani. They praised his vital role in the fight against terrorism in the region. Our correspondent Damascus has a report.
Resistance figures from Palestine, Syria, and Iraq have marked the first martyrdom anniversary of commander of Iran's Al-Quds force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, in Damascus, recalling his role in restoring stability to Syria. In a gathering, resistance delegates underlined the importance of his efforts in leading resistance in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Palestine.
General Soleimani exerted huge efforts to support Palestinians in Gaza and occupied territories. He had a great role in raising the morale of Palestinians in their fight against the Israeli aggression. He never interfered in the internal affairs of the Palestinians.
We have gathered here to pay tribute to two great leaders of resistance who lost their lives in fight against enemies of our causes. We tell those who want to create divisions among us that we will remain united and strong and will follow in the footsteps of General Soleimani.
On the 3rd of January 2020, U.S. President Donald Trump ordered strikes that killed General Soleimani and his companions near Baghdad International Airport.
Martyr Soleimani led battles in Aleppo and eastern Syria as well as around Damascus. His presence had always boosted the morale of fighters. His presence scared the enemy on the battlefield and at the same time gave power to resistance fighters.
The role of Martyr Soleimani and the alliance of Iraqi, Iranian, and Syrian resistance gave a lesson to the U.S. and its allies that they can't defeat our resistance, especially in Syria and Iraq.
Throughout the war on Syria, the general was a top strategist and military commander, leading Iranian military advisors who helped Syria at its government's request in the fight against terrorists. He frequently visited the front lines in Aleppo and Deir ez-Zor and joined resistance fighters for advisement, despite knowing he was a target for the U.S. and its allies. The general also took personal command of the battle against Daesh terrorists in the city of Bukamal in Deir ez-Zor countryside in November 2017. For resistance fighters, he was a commander and a father. For Syrians, he was a true friend and a hero. For the Syrian army, he was a brother and an ally who was there whenever needed. And this is how Martyr Qasem Soleimani will be remembered in Syria. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran anti-terror icon General Soleimani is just around the corner. Our correspondent in Afghanistan, Lebanon, and Yemen have talked to a number of people in those countries about the assassination.
The assassination of General Qasem Soleimani has not largely affected Iran's regional policies. The U.S. had thought that it could challenge Iran by assassinating the general, but it failed to do so. Likewise, the Islamic Republic has pressed ahead with its policies in the region.
General Soleimani was a key figure in combating terrorism and had a very active role in this regard. The United States assassinated him because it was aware of that fact.
Commander Soleimani was a devout Muslim who sacrificed his most precious possessions in order to protect and resurrection his nation and his people. He did most give the humiliation until he rose to the rank of martyr.
The martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani represented a great loss to the Islamic nation, as he was an example to be followed for the axis of resistance in the Middle East.
The killing of Soleimani was a loss to all Muslims. Whenever a hero goes, there are other people who continue the path of resistance. God willing, we will win.
This martyrdom proves the tyrannical and aggressive nature of the U.S. administration and also shows that resistance is deeply rooted in the hearts and minds of people. Whoever thinks that by killing a leader they can extinguish the flame of resistance, they are wrong.
Several European countries have started vaccinating their population against the coronavirus as a new strain is spreading throughout the continent and beyond. The countries using the Pfizer-BioNTech jabs for the mass vaccination include France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic. The most vulnerable groups, like the elderly and frontline healthcare workers, are the first ones to get the shots. The new variant of the virus that emerged in the UK has pushed the European Union to quickly launch the coordinated rollout of the vaccines. COVID-19 has killed some 340,000 people, affecting more than 14 million others in Europe. From Rome, let's bring in a correspondent, to Max Civoli. Max, tell us about the COVID situation there in Italy and how the vaccination is going there.
A 29-year-old nurse working at Rome's Spallanzani Infectious Diseases Hospital was the first person in Italy to be vaccinated this morning, as the nation's COVID-19 vaccination campaign starts today. Four more hospital employees were administered the Pfizer vaccine, with the Italian military in charge of distributing the vaccine to 21 sites across the nation. So far, Italy has received only a symbolic first batch of vaccines amounting to 9,750 doses, part of an EU procurement program. Italy is among the European countries which have agreed to coordinate the COVID-19 vaccination campaigns together with Germany, France, Belgium, Spain, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and Switzerland. Italy will share information on its progress in the vaccination program. The actual vaccination distribution will begin tomorrow, and Italy is set to receive about 407,000 vaccines each day. Now, who will be the first to get the vaccine? The health ministry has said that doctors and healthcare workers will get the first doses. We're talking some 1.4 million people. They'll be followed by residents in care homes, just over 570,000 people. And then those aged over 80 will be next in line, followed by those aged 60 to 79. Vaccines will be distributed then to key workers, teachers, police, prison wardens, and after that it will be offered to the general population, and the vaccine will be free and will not be obligatory. Now, the Italy health minister said this is a light at the end of the tunnel, but the bigger challenge may end up being psychological, how to convince people to actually take the shot. According to recent surveys, about two-thirds of Italian adults will be willing to get a COVID-19 vaccine, but achieving the herd immunity may mean at least 80% of people will need the vaccine. Italy has a quite a significant share of anti-vaxxers, and the main reasons for skepticism are questions about efficacy and fear of side effects. So it would be reckless to assume that Italians will automatically get in line to be administered the vaccine, and communication will be key as usual.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Max Civilipt in Rome. The World Health Organization is warning that COVID-19 outbreak won't be the last pandemic to hit the globe. It's calling for efforts to make the world a safer place for everyone.
History tells us that this will not be the last pandemic, and epidemics are a fact of life. But with investments in public health, supported by an all of government, all of society, one health approach, we can ensure that our children and their children inherit a safer, more resilient, and more sustainable world.
The WHO chief underlined that COVID-19 has messed up the world, leaving behind far-reaching consequences both for societies and economies. He noted that any efforts to improve human health are doomed unless they address the critical interface between human beings and animals. The World Health Organization has taken an initiative called the One Health Approach. It aims to design and implement programs, policies, legislation, and research for several sectors to bring the countries together for better public health outcomes. The Brexit trade deal the UK agreed with the EU on Thursday has raised objections both among British lawmakers and fishermen. Senior pro-Brexit Conservatives MP expressed alarm at plans to rush the 2,000-page document through Parliament in just one day. Former Brexit Secretary David Davis says he's only ready to give his in-principle approval. Other senior MPs say that they need time to scrutinize the agreement on sovereignty terms. The head of National Federation of Fishermen's Organizations says that his industry has been betrayed. He says the government went back on the promise to regain full control over fishing waters to get a wider agreement with the EU. The UK is leaving the customs union with the bloc and the European single market on the 1st of January. The country started to regain control over its fishing waters, will start to regain control over fishing waters only after a five-year transition period. Professor of International Economics Keith Pilbin says the UK's trade deal with the EU was the lesser of the two evils to avoid a no-deal scenario disaster.
Well, it will keep the Tories from a no-deal Brexit. You know, because a no-deal Brexit would be a complete disaster, and they know that. So, you know, this is better than no deal. I mean, no deal would have meant us imposing tariffs on the Europeans and then imposing tariffs on us with immediate effect. And that would have been absolutely disastrous. So we're talking of a disaster rather than an absolute disaster. On the other hand, the fishermen, let's be honest, it's 0.1% of the British economy. They were always going to be sold down the river, as we would say, by this government. No one's going to sacrifice some sort of deal for that. So they've got to vote, and they've got better than they had anyway. You know, it's not great for them, but it's not worse than that, so they won't be worse off. The trouble is, it says nothing about all the people that will be made worse off. The new bureaucrats I've got to pay for, 50,000 of them. All the customs declarations, we will start seeing the queues build up again. There's nothing on services. People have lost their rights to live and work abroad. So, in fact, it's not what's in the agreement, it's what's not in the agreement, all right? And what's not in the agreement is access to the single market in the way that we wanted it and we had it, you know? And we've gained nothing. I mean, we had tariff-free trade anyway, except we got tariff-free trade with loads of bureaucracy.
So much for that deal then. Bangladesh is planning to move more Rohingya refugees to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal, despite calls by rights group to stop that relocation. Officials have been quoted as saying that around 1,000 refugees will be moved to Basan Char Island in the second phase of the relocation. Dhaka claims it's only moving the people who are willing to move from the existing overcrowded camps hosting more than 1 million people. The UN, however, says it has not been allowed to carry out a safety assessment of the place where the refugees are being taken to. Refugees and humanitarian workers say that some of the Rohingya have been coerced into going to the island. Rohingya Muslims were forced to take refuge in Bangladesh after a wave of torture and killings in neighboring Myanmar. They have refused to go back for fear of further violence. The co-founder of the Free Rohingya Coalition, Ney San Lewin, says that the relocation of the Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh will result in further isolation of the vulnerable minority group.
For me, if I have to say my opinion, I don't like at all, because it is completely isolated, and also there is a threat by the cyclone, and also it looks like the prison. You know, you have no way to go back to the mainland, and there is no public transportation at all. And we don't know, maybe the NGO now, you know, in the beginning they are there, the hospital staff are there, doctor are there, but a few months later they can despair, they can leave from the island, because this island is will be always threatened by the cyclone, and also it is very far away from the mainland, you know, nobody want to stay. And if one, the Bangladeshi foreign minister said, you know, that they will turn it to the resort or the place for the homeless people. Even the homeless people didn't interest to move there.
Well, bad news in Iran. At least 10 climbers have died and several more gone missing in mountains north of the capital city, Tehran, following a heavy snowfall. Rescue workers have retrieved 9 bodies from the Elbrus mountain range, where the hikers were caught in a blizzard and an avalanche on Friday. One more individual lost his life in a hospital. Red Crescent teams have rescued 14 people. 7 are still unaccounted for. The search operation had to come to a halt at nightfall due to bad weather conditions. They resumed at the break of the day. Canada has reported the first 2 cases of a new and more contagious variant of the coronavirus, which first emerged in Britain. The acting chief medical officer for Ontario says that a couple was diagnosed with the strain in Durham municipality with no known travel history or exposure to high-risk contacts. The officer says the couple has been placed in quarantine. He also called for the reinforcement of a province-wide lockdown to stem the new strain. Many countries, including Japan, China, Brazil, and several European nations, have already reported cases of the far more quickly infectious disease. They've also suspended their flights to and from the UK. And that brings to the end of this broadcast.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
New military threats are taking shape. This is because threats are constantly changing. Therefore, our military academies should plan for confronting new threats. This should be taken into account in the research conducted by academies. They should have plans for confronting the threats. Besides, they should be able to predict the new threats. For example, today there are cyberspace threats, but they did not used to exist like this 10 years ago, and they might be transformed in a few years. Therefore, our intelligent experts should engage in predicting them by benefiting from collective thinking and from academic research. This should form an important part of our academy's activities, and academies should come up with important ideas in this regard. The next point is that our armed forces have gained valuable experiences during and even after the sacred defense era.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Some of the military tactics employed during the sacred defense era were really unprecedented in the world, and many of our operations have guaranteed the existence of valuable experience. We can mention Thamin al-A'immah, greetings be upon him, Fath al-Mubin, Bayt al-Muqaddas, Khaybar, Wal-Fajr 8, Kabbalah 5, and other such operations. Many extraordinary achievements were made in those victorious operations. Even in the operations in which we did not achieve victory, such as Operations Karbala 5, Ramadan, and the like, there are valuable experiences. Therefore, we should benefit from them. Today, mentioning these experiences is common practice in our academies, and this is very good, but it is not enough. These experiences should turn into theories. Experiences should turn into defensive theories, and then be taught and researched. They should become up to date so that they conform to present day needs and so that we can benefit from them, God willing. These are very valuable assets which should be developed and benefited from.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
United States has been waging a brutal campaign of economic warfare against Iran, also known as the Maximum Pressure Campaign. These sanctions have had a devastating effect on the country's economy and civilian population. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. In 2015, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran Nuclear Deal, was signed by Iran and the P5 plus one, meaning the United States, the UK, France, China, Russia, plus Germany. This agreement set out the framework whereby sanctions against Iran would be lifted in exchange for Iran curbing its nuclear capabilities. And indeed, Iran complied fully with the agreement. This was verified by the United Nations nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency. And in 2016, all oil and financial sanctions were lifted, releasing almost $100 billion to Iran in frozen assets. However, in 2018, Donald Trump unilaterally pulled the United States out of the Iran nuclear deal, claiming that Iran was violating the agreement. This, of course, was not true, and no one shared this view, not the United States' own European allies, nor the international inspectors from the IAEA. The Trump regime then moved to reimpose crippling sanctions targeting Iran's oil sector, aircraft exports, precious metals, construction imports, and financial transactions. What the Trump regime wanted was to renegotiate the deal with Iran in order to dismantle Iran's ballistic missile program and to stop Iran from supporting resistance efforts in the Middle East. Effectively, what the United States did here is go back on its own word, not even 3 years after striking this deal, and then with such overt and brazen greed, proceed to ask for even more concessions. This proves that there never really was an existential threat or fear of Iran obtaining a nuclear bomb like we heard so often and still do. What Washington wants is for Tehran to abandon its ballistic missiles program because this benefits Israel and Saudi Arabia. Moreover, Washington would love to limit Tehran and contain Iran's influence in the region, preventing Iran from fighting the illegal occupation of Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq by the Zionists and the Americans. So, of course, the United States resorts to lies, to propaganda, and ridiculous smears using the mainstream media as its vehicle, which reminded me of the days in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003 when they were constantly talking about weapons of mass destruction, 24/7. Now they have a new slogan, a new catchphrase, but for Iran, where they say, Iran is the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism, and they try to use that in order to justify their imperialist aggression and conquest. Iran is no stranger to U.S. sanctions, but the Trump administration has been running what it calls the Maximum Pressure Campaign, led by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. This Maximum Pressure Campaign is designed to exert as much pressure and wreak as much havoc as possible on the economies of countries that the United States has targeted for regime change, just like Iran, just like Syria, Venezuela, and this always results in widespread suffering and death for the civilian population. Simply put, this is economic terrorism. This is a modern version of siege warfare, and it is cruel, it is inhumane, and it is illegal under international law. After leaving the JCPOA, we've seen the United States slap Iran with new sanctions almost every week. The U.S. has been so adamant in trying to put new sanctions on Iran that it even tried to trigger snapback sanctions at the United Nations Security Council earlier this year in August and bring back this UN arms embargo that consequently expired in October. This motion failed miserably, and it was a huge diplomatic embarrassment for the United States. Out of the 15 members who sit on the UN Security Council, the United States and the Dominican Republic were the only ones who voted for the resolution, with the other 13 members either voting against it or abstaining. This desperation was made even more obvious by the fact that the U.S.'s own allies, France, the U.K., and Germany, abstained from the vote. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Kelly Craft, insisted that they would be re-implementing U.N. sanctions on Iran, despite the U.N. not being on board and voting the resolution down. There were no U.N. sanctions returning on Iran. The arms embargo expired. But because there is such a lack of international support, in order to save face, that's what they've been saying. And it just proves how pathetic and farcical this entire campaign is. Just to further underscore how ardent the U.S. has been in its pursuit of economic warfare against Iran, Donald Trump's national security advisor, Robert O'Brien, even said that the U.S. has imposed so many sanctions on Iran that there's, quote, very little left for us to do. Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif tweeted a few days ago, quite accurately, I might add, that the United States is addicted to sanctions. I think it's putting it mildly. Just to further underscore this sustained campaign of aggression against Iran, not only did the U.S. pull out of the JCPOA, it also assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The U.S. then flew a drone into Iranian airspace, violating Iran's sovereignty, and then issued a rebuke in response when Iran shot down, rightfully so, their unmanned aircraft. They've also threatened to pirate Iranian shipments of fuel to Venezuela, who's also struggling under brutal sanctions by the U.S. And in a separate incident, we also saw U.S. jets harass a civilian commercial airliner from Mahan Air that was flying over Lebanese airspace. These provocations are no accident and have been designed to complement this maximum pressure campaign. Nonetheless, the implications are not all military. The results of these sanctions can be felt in all areas of life. What the United States and their allies would like you to believe is that sanctions are some kind of harmless tool, a dull blade wielded in order to exert political pressure. But the reality on the ground is that scores of civilians end up starving and suffering and dying at the hands of these brutal sanctions, this economic terrorism. Let's call it for what it is. We've seen this before when the U.S. killed untold numbers of children in Iraq with sanctions in the early 90s. We're seeing this right now in Syria with the brutal Caesar Act sanctions, causing people to wait in breadlines in a country that was once self-sufficient in food. We're seeing this in Venezuela where people have no fuel and nothing to eat. 40,000 people minimum have died already because of U.S. sanctions. And we're seeing this now as well in Iran. We're seeing the effect there as well, where people are forced to go without medicine during a pandemic. Iran's health minister, Namaki, said earlier this month that the sanctions imposed on Iran by the U.S. have targeted medicine and medical equipment. Now, even though the United States claims its sanctions don't target things like medicine or medical supplies or food, European and other international partners end up being dissuaded from trading with Iran out of fear of retaliation and being slapped with secondary sanctions. In October of this year, the United States moved to sanction Iran's entire financial sector, blacklisting 18 of its banks, shutting it out completely of global markets and making it extremely difficult for businesses and, more importantly, for the government to buy medicine and medical supplies. How can countries like the United States and the United Kingdom profess to be liberal democracies who uphold international law and oppose tyranny when they are responsible for murdering scores of innocent civilians with their barbaric siege warfare? Never mind the wars, never mind the bombings, the drone strikes, the invasions. It seems that their idea of bringing democracy to others entails starving off entire populations and putting them through unspeakable misery. The fact that one would do this at any time is cruel enough. But the fact that the United States has not only continued these sanctions, but increased them during a global pandemic further exposes how brutal their foreign policy is and further proves this point. The United Nations and numerous other international bodies have all called on the U.S. to end its brutal sanctions, to end this ridiculous maximum pressure campaign amid the coronavirus crisis, calls that the United States has completely and utterly ignored. The sanctions are so severe that they have spurred the growth of a black market, leaving Iranians without medicines that they desperately need or being forced to pay obscene amounts just to obtain them. How could anyone justify such economic and medical terrorism? We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me now to talk more is Dr. Said Sarkar, Professor of Medical Physics at Tehran University of Medical Sciences. Thank you for coming on, Professor. I wanted to ask you, the United States claims that its sanctions don't target humanitarian goods like medicines and food. How have U.S. sanctions impacted Iran's ability to obtain drugs, medical equipment, and medical supplies?
The U.S. sanction really has paralyzed the Iranian health sector. When they try to buy some special equipment or some pharmaceuticals or devices for patients, they are not able to do so. Although they say there is no sanction on health sector, but anyway, we cannot transfer money because all the sanctions through on the Iranian banks, which are not able to transfer money to the companies who they from they buy their facilities. Is that somehow that they say, okay, you are allowed to buy things or get hold of these pharmaceuticals? They block the way. So it's untouchable or unreachable because if you want to buy them, you have to pay them, pay the companies. And also, the companies are worried after they say they will be punished by the U.S. Authorities. This is really terrible. This sanction has paralyzed us and has a profound effect on our health sector, and really people are suffering from these sanctions, and they have taken the Iranian nation as economic hostage, and really they are blackmailing Iranian population to impose their will on our nation.
I believe President Rouhani also said that these U.S. sanctions are preventing Iran from obtaining a COVID vaccine from the World Health Organization. Could you elaborate on that for us?
Yes, that's right. They have been trying to buy this COVID vaccine from several weeks ago, and unfortunately, they have not been able to transfer money to pay for the cost of these vaccines. And also, as I mentioned, these companies are really worried about the punishment which will follow their business with Iran. And this is a bunch of lies that they deliver. And I don't know the American policymakers, especially President Trump, they are saying that there is no sanction on the health sector, but in reality, we cannot do anything regarding our health sector.
So, Professor, how has Iran managed to cope despite the sanctions? What is Iran doing? What kind of innovations have we seen coming out of this crisis?
At the beginning, we had a lot of problems providing PPE and also ventilators and other necessary consumables and drugs for our patients that really was hurting. But we are not going to sit and surrender. And somehow we thought that we should do something about it. And fourthly, especially our knowledge-based companies started their R&D activities, and through technology development, we overcome some of these problems. For example, regarding facial masks, N95, things we had the technology on nanofiber technology, we were able, using nanofiber technology, to produce N95 and even N99 facial masks. At the beginning, our production capacity was about 20,000 masks per day, but fortunately, within 2 weeks, we increased our production capacity in 200,000 masks per day because we had the technology and we were producing the industrial machinery and the production line. And Iran is one of the few countries who have the technology to build up this nanofiber technology, which makes us capable of producing N95 masks. And We are producing all hand sanitizers using nanomaterials like nanosilver particles or titanium oxide particles, and also we are producing air purification, and top scientists managed to make a system for COVID, detection of COVID patients. It's called the RDS, rust detector, and within less than 30 seconds, using these nanosensors to detect those who are affected with COVID-19 virus. They dip the nanosensor inside the sputum. If the person is affected with the virus, within 30 seconds, the system will be able to detect the rust, which is a byproduct of, virus in the lung. So the patients who have lung inflammation, by the virus, this system will immediately detect them.
And Iran has been developing its own COVID vaccine, correct?
Several Iranian companies are engaged in developing COVID-19 vaccine. Several of them are using virus or the kill virus, but two of these companies are using, the edge of the technology, and also nanolipid particles to produce vaccines like what, BioNTech and Pfizer or Moderna use the technology. And we hope that within next 6 months, we will be able to start vaccination in Iran by Iranian-made vaccine, the top range of the technology. And fingers crossed, some of the companies have passed even an animal trial, and we need to do the clinical trial on people. And hopefully, we will be able to provide our people with Iranian-made vaccine.
In terms of regular medicines and medication, how much harder have they become to obtain? And how have U.S. sanctions impacted that?
Regarding the regular medicine, we don't have much of the problem because Iranian industry, pharmaceutical industry, is capable of producing ordinary or regular drugs. But regarding special drugs for, special patients in cancer or like hemophilia or some other special disease, there are severe effects on these groups of patients, which they cannot really find these drugs in pharmacies, and they need to go to black market and pay several times more to buy these drugs. So this is really hurting and has put a severe pressure on these innocent patients regarding, this is the result of what the U.S. doing with the ordinary people. And, it's really unbearable.
Doctor, thank you so much for your time and for all your hard work. I really appreciate having you on the show. Thank you so much. The effects of these sanctions on Iran's economy are also undeniable. Just last month, Mike Pompeo was even bragging about how the U.S. has crippled Iran's economy by devaluing its currency, the rial, increasing public debt and inflation, and reducing the number of barrels of oil that the country is able to export. The fact that we regularly see the U.S. Secretary of State gloat about this exposes a shameless imperialist arrogance, how these imperialists are proud of causing the death and destruction of others. And it's important to note how everything is interconnected. Again, while the United States pretends that its sanctions don't target humanitarian goods, this is a flat-out lie and a denial of the reality on the ground and the suffering of countless people that is inflicted by the United States and their allies. Now that Joe Biden has been officially declared the president-elect by the Electoral College, one must ponder what lies next in terms of sanctions with the incoming Biden administration. Biden was vice president, after all, under Obama when the Iran nuclear deal, when the JCPOA was negotiated, and reaffirmed earlier this month in an interview with the New York Times that the U.S. would rejoin the deal if Iran adheres to the agreement. Once again, this is a bit of a nonsensical statement, because Iran has always adhered to the agreement and protocols of the JCPOA, whereas the United States did not and tore up the deal. So it's frankly ridiculous that the U.S. expects something from Iran. It's on the U.S. to show some goodwill and prove that they can engage in long-lasting diplomacy, not the other way around. It's worth noting that we've seen calls from Germany and the United States that they want to renegotiate the Iran nuclear deal, calling it a nuclear deal plus. But these are all iterations of the same thing. What they want is what Trump originally said, which is to curb Iran's ballistic missile program and to contain Iran's influence in the region and to stop it from resisting against the Zionist and American occupations. That's what it comes down to. They're all going back on what they originally agreed to, which is utterly absurd. Iran has made it absolutely clear that they will not renegotiate the nuclear deal. I mean, why should they? The P5 plus one couldn't even follow the original nuclear deal. Iran did, and was treated with disdain in return. So as long as there's a clear understanding between the two sides that the sanctions are lifted, then perhaps there will be a return to some sort of normalcy in that regard. However, what a lot of media stenographers and some of the U.S. own allies are saying is that they want to renegotiate this deal, get rid of Iran's nuclear capabilities and ballistic missile program, and cripple the access of resistance. This is off the table, and that's not happening. After the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Dr. Fakhrizadeh last month, the Iranian parliament passed a draft resolution that sets out to enrich more of Iran's uranium up to 20%, which is much higher than the 3.67% set out in the JCPOA, and to beef up its nuclear program in 2 months' time. That time frame is no accident. What they're doing is essentially giving the Biden administration a chance to see if they'll lift any of the sanctions before actually going ahead with it. Now, President Rouhani has expressed concerns about the draft resolution and said earlier this week that he has no doubt the U.S. will rejoin the Iran nuclear deal and lift all the sanctions. Iran's leader also addressed the topic of sanctions in a televised statement this week. He said there are two ways to tackle sanctions. Number one is removing them. Number two is to nullify and overcome them. He said that Iran tried the first option, tried removing sanctions by negotiating for a few years, but to no use. The second option, he said, may have difficulties in the beginning, but will have a favorable end. And indeed, that does seem to be what Iran has been doing. You know, what the United States and its Treasury Department did not consider is that Iran does not rely solely on oil. Iran has a very diverse economy with many means to fall back on and is able to barter and still navigate around the sanctions with other allies in the region and internationally. Even though the economy is in a bad shape because of the sanctions and people are suffering and dying, it is still a mark of resilience. And the country has been able to withstand sanctions, not just now, but for the last 40 years. This is something that Iranians, Syrians, and other peoples targeted by the U.S. empire know all too well. The United States thinks that it can cripple these countries and slowly choke off their resources. But ironically, it ends up forcing them to adopt self-sufficiency, bringing them closer to each other, increasing cooperation, and letting them find new intuitive ways to deal with the harsh measures imposed on them. Venezuela, for example, which has also been targeted by this maximum pressure campaign and that's economic terrorism from the U.S., was able to fulfill its fuel needs by trading directly with Iran. Even Iran's defense capabilities have proven to be formidable, especially for a country under economic duress. Just this August, we saw Iran unveil two new missiles, a cruise missile named after the martyred Abu Mahdi Mohandes and a ballistic missile named after the martyred Haj Qasem. Despite these brutal sanctions, we've seen Iran develop its own COVID-19 testing, working on its own vaccine. We've seen Iran helping Syria in its fight against the foreign-backed terrorists sent by the West. We've also seen Iran send aid to its brothers in Venezuela, who are also engaged in the fight against Western imperialism and suffering under the same brutal sanctions. Even in public infrastructure, just look at how Iran is doing better than the country sanctioning it, the United States, which is supposedly the richest nation on earth. Once again, through its imperialist foreign policy, the United States exposes itself as incapable of engaging in genuine, substantive diplomacy based on mutual respect and cooperation. Instead, the U.S. prefers to engage in conquest, siege warfare, economic terrorism, subjecting millions of people around the globe to inhumane and crippling sanctions. But if anything, this has shown Iran to be resilient. and strong and capable of enduring even in the face of adversity. And Iran remains steadfast in its fight against imperialism, along with its brothers in Syria and Venezuela and the global south, and they will not be defeated. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shimanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of law.
Listeners special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, December 27th, 2020. I'm Atef Erfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails and letters. So contact us and tell us what you think about our programs, or if you have any messages for our dear listeners around the world, then record your voice and send it to us and get your voice heard. Remember, Listeners Special is the Sunday program, and it's your program. It's your views that are important. And congratulations to our Christian listeners on the occasion of Christmas and New Year 2021, which is going to start very soon. Oh, well, may peace prevails all over the earth and the coronavirus leaves the world as soon as possible. Amen. Dear listeners, stay with us until the end of the program. We have so many emails and letters from around the world. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, the Sunday program, your program. And as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. These reception reports, as you may know, are very useful and important to us, especially to our technicians and engineers. These reception reports enable us to provide a better service to our dear listeners throughout the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will normally be receiving a QSL card from IRIB English Radio. However, these days, with the outbreak of coronavirus pandemic around the world, please don't expect a QSL card from IRIB English Radio. As you know, sending any material, including paper QSL cards or souvenirs of IRIB English Radio on behalf of our radio, is temporarily halted due to the coronavirus pandemic. And here, I truly appreciate those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Anatoly Klepov from Russia, also Assis Hernando from Spain, and Musharraf Hussein from India. Well, Anatoly, Assis, and Musharraf, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. And a million thanks to those of our listeners who have kindly sent us letters and emails, which I mentioned some of their names here, and later during our program, I read their emails. Well, from India, we have an email from Dr. Hemant Kumar. Dr. Hemant Kumar is one of our regular listeners. Also, we have an email from Mickey Delmash from Canada. Mickey Delmash is also one of our faithful listeners. Also, we have an email from Jolt Woodstra from Netherlands. I hope I'm right in pronouncing his or her name. And also from Sweden, we have an email from Krister Bronstorm. Krister Bronstorm is also one of our regular listeners. Also, we have an email from Ulmar Kovic from Sweden, which is one of our regular listeners. Thank you, all of you who have sent us emails and letters. Dear listeners, stay with us until the end of the program. I will be back with all these kind messages just in seconds after the music. This is Listeners Special, and I'm back with lots of emails and letters from around the world, including an email from Dr. Hemant Kumar from India. Dr. Hemant Kumar from India says, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year 2021. May the new year give you the strength to face the challenges of life and courage to adjust the sail so as to take every situation to your stride. Oh, very beautiful. First of all, salam and greetings to you, Dr. Hemant Kumar from India. And many thanks for this really beautiful message on the occasion of Christmas and New Year. We also, in IRB English Radio, again, congratulate our Christian listeners a very happy Christmas and New Year 2021. Wish you all the best. Also, Dr. Hemant Kumar from India, and also our Christian friends and listeners around the world. Dr. Hemant Kumar, thank you again. Keep in touch with IRIB English Radio. Also, from Canada, we have an email from Mickey Delmash. Mickey Delmash is one of our regular listeners who says, Dear friends, I hope all of you are healthy and happy. I would like to convey my heartfelt greetings on New Year 2021. May the merciful God bless us all and our family with ever-ending happiness, peace, and prosperity. I will be further obliged if you kindly accept my reception report and verify it with a paper QSL. Four audio recordings of parts of the broadcast are attached for verification purpose. Salam and greetings to you, Mickey Delmash from Canada, and also, lots of gratitude to you for this happy email to IRIB English Radio. Please accept our congratulations on Christmas and New Year 2021, which is going to start very soon. All of us, and also thank you very much for sharing your congratulation message to us and our dear listeners around the world. Yes, we've received your audio recordings of parts of the broadcast in